Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison, and I'll be your host as we go through recent developments in the public safety labor world. And I do have some cases that I want to talk to you about, most notably that Illinois Supreme Court case that details what happens when a public records law collides with a purging clause in a disciplinary provision in a collective bargaining agreement. But before I get there, I have three smaller things that are not case related that I want to talk to you about. And the first is mostly personal. It's what's going on in my home city of Portland. And unfortunately, the news is not good. We have had protests now in Portland for well over 2 months. For a while, the federal government sent various law enforcement officers into town, and every night seemed almost like a ritualized dance. You'd have peaceful protesters out, they'd be downtown, they'd be around the federal courthouse or in the park across the street from it, they'd give speeches, some people would be dancing, some people would be singing. And then at about 10 o'clock or at 11 o'clock at night, the other people would show up. And those people would be the ones who don't really seem to care about what the protest movement is all about. Or if they do care, there's no way of telling it. Instead, what they are into is something that is as close as I have ever seen in my life to anarchy. They simply aren't interested in any sort of discussion, any sort of solution to any sort of problem, may not even be interested in the problems. So these folks, and I'll call them the rioters, would start up at 11 o'clock or midnight, and they would attack the federal courthouse. And they'd attack it in various ways. The federal government put a fence around the courthouse. The rioters would tear it down, usually successfully, sometimes only try. They would shoot fireworks, and when I say fireworks, translate that to being mortars or commercial-grade fireworks at the building. They would light fires next to the building, and whenever the building was enough in jeopardy, the federal government would come out, and it would disperse the crowd by shooting tear gas and less lethal weapons. And of course, because the peaceful protesters were still there, and in fact, in many cases, were being used for cover by the rioters, the peaceful protesters would get hit by the rubber bullets, or they'd inhale the tear gas, or whatever it might be. And then there'd be all sorts of arguments that the federal government was overreacting that you would see the next day. And then we would do this every single blessed night. Well, in terms of the business I'm in, which is representing police unions, on two occasions, the protesters attacked the building that is owned by the Portland Police Association. It's 5-6 miles from downtown. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the federal courthouse or anything like that. The protesters on two occasions actually were able to breach the police association building. They have attempted on three occasions to set fire to the building, and one of those occasions was last night. By this point, the police union building is completely boarded up. The protesters were able to break through the plywood that was on a rear door, broke down a glass door, and entered a place that is used basically for breaks by on-duty police officers. So lots of chairs and TVs on the wall and, you know, that sort of thing. Protesters ripped a TV off the wall, threw it on the ground, and lit a fire. And the result was that the police then came out in force, and we just had a general mess in front of the police association building, including some shots being fired by who knows who, not the police, and a truck that was driving through the middle of the protesters. As all of that has been going on one evening, the people came to my office. We think They came somewhere in the middle of the night, oh dark 30. Wasn't a lot of them, but at least one of them, or probably two of them, had bricks, and they threw bricks through the plate glass windows of my office. They also sprayed graffiti on the garage door to my office. As three lines of graffiti, and the words were about 2 feet high, each line about 2 feet high. And the first line said KKOP. We think they kind of misspelled that. They meant to say KKKOP, but only KKOP. And then underneath it, lawyer scum. And that, of course, cleaning up all of that has cost us thousands of dollars, and it leaves you with a significant sense of insecurity. Mine is not the only police union law firm that has been hit by this sort of behavior. The Mastagni law firm down in Sacramento has been hit. Reports are three separate times. I know of a law firm in Kansas City and another in Lincoln that has been treated exactly the same way. So my caution to all of the police unions out there who are listening to this, and to the police union lawyers out there, take care of yourselves. Take care of the security of your buildings. And that means, among other things, making sure you have off-site electronic backup, and you make sure that everything of any value is removed from your buildings. I can't tell you how much I hate giving that advice, but unfortunately, that seems to be the world in which we are presently living. Hopefully, this stops. It must stop, right? Okay, on to the labor world, and two things of note about the labor world. First of all, I've been cautioning people for a long time about social media use, and certainly with the protests, we have seen a huge uptick in discipline for public safety employees, firefighters, police officers, corrections officers, all of them are doing it, being disciplined for off-duty social media use. It used to be that we would collect these social media articles through the news trawlers that we have at LRAS. And, you know, we might get one or two a week or something like that. Some weeks in the last 2 months, we've gotten well over a dozen articles that usually have a headline like "Firefighter Fired for Off-Duty Social Media Posts." So this is just a reminder to everybody, please talk to your employees, talk to your members, make sure they understand this is not the time to be expressing yourself on social media. And now, speaking in particular to employees and their labor organizations, there's a big push, an advertising push on the internet from various companies that are helping employers triage their employees' social media use. I'm just going to talk to you about one of them. There are others, and we'll post a link here so you'll be able to see it. This is to an organization that is called Ferretly. And Ferretly prides itself in being AI, artificial intelligence powered social media screening. And they have separate pages for different industries. For example, there's one for law enforcement. And what they will do is, for a not all that expensive price, is they will scour the social media use of all of your employees. They'll look for aliases, they'll look for any information that they can get that your employees are using social media inappropriately. And if you don't believe that these sorts of organizations exist, you need to check out the webpage that we're posting as a link. So caution, these sorts of tools not only are out there, they are going to increase in sophistication. As Ferretly says, this is what they pride themselves in, and I'm quoting, social media screening should become an integral part of the pre-employment and ongoing recertification process. Using artificial intelligence, public posts can be scanned and monitored for any red flags, including hate speech, threats of violence, self-harm, insults, bullying, and more. They even have a fancy alert system where they will let an employer know that the employee may be abusing their social media accounts. Okay, last of my third charming pieces of news to start off this podcast. I kind of apologize for being a downer today, but that's just kind of where the news is right now. And I want to talk about a question that came into LRIS's Q&A line. If you go to our webpage at LRIS, you'll see we have a Q&A section. And people write in from all over, and they write a variety of different questions. And I will try to answer as many of them as I can. Sometimes I'll refer people to local lawyers because the questions are too specific. And of course, I always advise everybody to disregard my advice because I'm not actually their lawyer. Well, a really interesting question came in yesterday that's very topical with respect to COVID-19. And I wanted to talk to you about both the question and my answer, because it may well be that you're starting to get questions like this yourself. And this came in from a supervisor, a lieutenant. And he asked, I wondered if you had any case law specific to mass and religions, or anything you could point me to that predates the pandemic. So in other words, at least the way I construed this question, is what happens if you have an employee who is refusing to wear a mask because the employee is taking the position that wearing a mask violates one of their religious tenets? How does that sort of case come out? Well, of course, we don't have any law on that yet, right? Because nobody was wearing masks until about 3-4 months ago, maybe even longer ago than that. Boy, does time fly, 5-6 months ago. So we don't have any law on point, but we do have some analogous cases out there that I think we can be pretty comfortable in predicting how such a case would come out. So there are any number of religious discrimination cases involving things like grooming, hairstyles, beards, clothing. There's a couple of cases on female corrections officers who objected on religious grounds to wearing pants, and accessories such as jewelry. And with one broad exception that I'll get to in a moment, courts have upheld those sorts of regulations against religious discrimination challenges and have even upheld terminations of employment for employees who do not comply with the employer's dress code. Certainly the biggest case that is out there is a case involving the city of Arlington, Texas, from many years ago. And a federal appeals court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, upheld the discharge of an Arlington officer who was Christian and refused to remove a small cross from his lapel, from basically the collar of his shirt. And the court said, look, employer gets to control the contents of the uniform. The employee doesn't. And if the employee refuses to remove that cross, that's insubordination, and the employee can be terminated. Other courts have upheld similar requirements that officers shave or officers cut their hair and conform to a hair length code. And the rationale of these courts is always pretty much the same. Law enforcement employers, firefighter employers have tremendous latitude in their ability to control how officers present themselves to the public. Now, the one exception to all of this, the one deviation from the general rule, is if an employer doesn't uniformly enforce its rules. So I actually talked about this on a podcast a couple of months ago. There's a recent Fire Department of New York case involving a firefighter who was in the disciplinary system for refusing to shave his beard. He suffered from this hair condition that is known as pseudofolliculitis barbae, an inflammation that is aggravated by shaving. And the firefighter was in a situation where if he complied with the employer's grooming code, he was going to be in a tremendous amount of pain and at greater risk for infection. And the question was, is that enforceable? And of course, that firefighter had two types of discrimination claims, had a discrimination claim under the Americans with Disabilities Act, because PFB, as it's called, is a health condition. And also, the firefighter had a race discrimination claim because PFB attacks Black men at a much higher rate than any other group of individuals. So the employer in that case had made exceptions in the past for employees who could not shave. And then you had a new boss come in who said, no more exceptions. And the court said, you know what? You made exceptions in the past. And so that tells us that this is a reasonable accommodation. You're going to have to keep making those exceptions. And then across the Hudson River, you have an older case from the City of Newark Police Department where the city had made exceptions for officers who suffered from PFB and allowed them to wear beards. And then, of course, the next officer who comes along is a Muslim officer who says, my religious beliefs prevent me from shaving. And the court looked at that and said, well, you've made exceptions for officers with this medical condition. You cannot refuse to make the same exception on religious discrimination grounds. So with that backdrop, that case law backdrop, my prediction is employers are going to be allowed to require officers to wear masks even over religious objections. And the question is going to come down to, will the employer have to do something to reasonably accommodate the officer? And reasonable accommodation is always on a case-by-case basis. And the question is going to be, is there some assignment where the employer decides that wearing a mask is not an essential function of the job? And because it's such a case-by-case thing, it's kind of hard to predict how that's going to come out. But my prediction is that in light of the overwhelming evidence that we are now seeing that masks prevent the transmission of COVID-19, a court is going to greatly defer to an employer's judgment as to whether such maskless positions exist. So bottom line, I think an employer is going to be able to have a mandatory mask policy and will be allowed to enforce that policy even over the religious objections of employees, unless the employer is inconsistent in the way it enforces the policy. Okay, on to Illinois and the question of purging clauses and a Public Records Act request. Bear with me a little bit as I go through the facts on this because they're fairly involved and they go back a long time. And I'm going to try to put them together in a way that makes a great deal of sense. So this is a dispute that starts really in January 1981, which is when the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 7 in Chicago, negotiates its first contract with the city of Chicago. They agreed to a purging clause in the collective bargaining agreement that required that material be removed from an officer's files, disciplinary material, 5 years after the date of the incident or the date upon which the violation was discovered whichever was longer. This is section 8.4 of the collective bargaining agreement. I'll probably call it that in the course of describing what this case holds. So that's 1981. And until 1991, the city routinely destroyed records subject to the purging clause. And that all changed in 1991 when a federal trial court entered an order in a civil rights case that required the city to stop destroying a subset of the disciplinary files. And the subset was something that is known as complaint register files. Other federal court judges began entering similar orders as a matter of routine. The city went back to the bargaining table with the FOP, tried to either eliminate Section 8.4 from the CBA, from the contract, or to try to modify it, but the city was never successful. Fast forward another 20 years to 2011, when the FOP files a couple of grievances over the city's failure to destroy complaint register files, the same one that the federal court 20 years before, same types of files, the federal court had ordered not to be destroyed. So the FOP is filing grievances saying, look, you're not destroying these complaint register files. The city denies both of the grievances and the FOP initiates arbitration. Well, it takes a while for things to get to arbitration, and the cases are still not heard 3 years later, in October of 2014, when the city gets a request under the Illinois Freedom of Information Act from the two big newspapers in Chicago, the Tribune and the Sun-Times, and they want complaint register files dating back to 1967. All sorts of different court proceedings result from that, and a trial court ends up granting the FOP's request for an injunction barring the release of the complaint register files until the arbitrations can be had. That's December 2014. December 2015, we still don't have an arbitrator's decision, and the Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Justice, announces that it's opened a civil pattern and practice investigation, civil rights pattern and practice investigation of the Chicago Police Department, one that focuses on excessive force and discriminatory policing. And the Department of Justice sends the city a letter. It's called a document preservation letter. That's something that lawyers routinely send in anticipation of litigation. And the letter says to the city, stop destroying your disciplinary files, among other things. So by the time the city gets that letter, they actually have picked an arbitrator. And the arbitrator, I don't know where it is in the hearing process, the court's opinion doesn't indicate that, but the city informs the arbitrator of what the Department of Justice has done and asks for guidance from the arbitrator. How should we respond to the Department of Justice? And the arbitrator takes the bull by the horns and a month later issues an interim award and finds that the city must comply with the purging clause in the collective bargaining agreement until it is negotiated basically out of existence. And that, of course, sends the Department of Justice into a tizzy. An assistant U.S. attorney sends a letter to the city saying, don't you dare comply with the arbitrator's award. And eventually, the whole mess ends up in the lap of the Illinois Supreme Court. And the court, for all that complicated history, ends up with a fairly straightforward question. What prevails? The provisions of a Freedom of Information Act, which mandate the retention of records, or the provisions of the collective bargaining agreement, which require their destruction? And the court answers the question, Freedom of Information Act wins. And let me read you a few sentences from the court's opinion, and you'll see the court's rationale here. The court says, quote, while parties are generally free to make their own contracts, this court has long held that when a conflict exists between a contract provision and state law, as it clearly does in this case, state law prevails. This doctrine is based on the common law notion that courts will not lend judicial power to the enforcement of private agreements that are immoral or illegal. That is the precise situation here, where a provision in a collective bargaining agreement contravenes explicit state law. Now, the decision of the Illinois Supreme Court here is not alone. Surprisingly, it doesn't look like the court recognizes that this issue has been litigated in other states. It has, for example, about 10 years ago, there was a very important decision from the Connecticut Supreme Court that dealt with the same question. And to the best of my knowledge, in every one of these cases, the courts have reached the same result, that a purging clause in a collective bargaining agreement cannot require the destruction of documents that a public records law or freedom of information law mandates be preserved. Now, if you're a union and you're worried about purging, there are some ways around this. And by the way, I think unions are very legitimately concerned about purging. I can remember once dealing with an employer where it was a state police agency where a trooper had gotten into a backing accident. And the employer was claiming that it was progressively disciplining the trooper by giving the trooper a 5-day suspension. What was the prior discipline upon which the progressive discipline was based? It was another accident. So, potentially progressive discipline that happened 23 years before. And the whole notion behind purging clauses is, we ought to be able to improve ourselves. We ought to be able to reinvent ourselves. I mean, heck, we change just about every cell in our bodies every 7 years. We ought to be able to change our behavior, and we should not be punished for things that happened long ago in the past. So I get the rationale behind purging clauses. And if you want to preserve that rationale, albeit in a different form, the purging clause would not require the destruction of the documents. It instead would simply seal them off from use as part of the progressive discipline process for X number of years in the future, whatever the timeline is that you want. Now, one last point about these purging clauses. If you're in the law enforcement world, there's a big focus on these right now as part of the police reform effort. Anytime you see a list of the top 10 things that police reformers want, they want to get rid of purging clauses in a collective bargaining agreement. So if you have one of these clauses in your contract, you should be thinking about alternatives right now as to how you can still protect employees from the use of stale discipline without potentially violating a state law that mandates the retention of the records. Our next case is another important one, and it's from Ohio. And this is one that deals with a question you see come up time and time again, but you don't see it litigated much. You just see people talking about it a lot. What's the relationship between a collective bargaining agreement and a memorandum of understanding? Are they both enforceable? What happens if you have a whole bunch of memoranda of understanding out there and your collective bargaining agreement expires? Do those memoranda of understanding expire as well? So how does this whole system work? Well, this case from Ohio gives us a partial answer to that question. This all starts, this involves the city of Brook Park, Ohio. It starts in February of 2017, and the city council passes an ordinance calling for the city to pay hospitalization and medical insurance benefits to retired employees in an amount that equated to a $100 a month premium or $100 a month benefit. Lodge 17 of the Fraternal Order of Police, this is FOP Day today on the podcast, I guess, which represents the city police officers, filed a grievance challenging the ordinance. And the FOP said, look, we had a 2009 memorandum of understanding, so 8 years before the ordinance was passed, we had this 2009 MOU, and it called for much more generous health care benefits than for retirees than the ordinance required. So the grievance ends up in arbitration. The arbitrator ends up applying the terms of the MOU and upheld the grievance and ordered the city to comply with the 2009 MOU with the more generous benefits. The city then challenges the decision in court. Now, a word about Ohio for a moment. Most states in the country, when they look at challenges to arbitrators' opinions, are not going to pause very long before upholding the arbitrator's opinion. Final and binding arbitration means something to most courts in this country, and that means that the decisions of arbitrators are final and binding. Ohio, not so much, not all the time. And this case, I think, is a pretty good example of that. So the Court of Appeals here strikes down the arbitrator's opinion. So what's the court's rationale? The court says, first of all, retirees in general are not subject to the grievance procedure in a collective bargaining agreement unless they're specifically included. And in this case, they are not specifically included. So here's what the court says, and I'm going to quote. The dispute in this matter cannot be said to be rationally derived from the collective bargaining agreement. The FOP is not designated as a representative of retirees under the collective bargaining agreement. There are no provisions in the collective bargaining agreement that concern retiree health insurance reimbursement benefits, and the contract limits a grievance to a dispute or difference concerning the interpretation or application of any provision in the contract. So the court ends up concluding, look, there's nothing in this contract about retiree medical benefits, and because there's nothing in the contract, we can't be considering the past practice because it doesn't relate to anything in the contract. And therefore, the arbitrator exceeded his jurisdiction and the opinion is not enforceable. The arbitrator's opinion is not enforceable. So, first of all, is the court right? No, of course not. It's not right. Past practice can actually create an implied term of a collective bargaining agreement if the past practice is unequivocal and easily determined. And here you have a past practice that goes back 8 years. And it's clearly easily determined because you have an MOU that describes what the past practice actually is. So I think the court simply did not have a good understanding of labor law, and that is that a collective bargaining agreement, in addition to having explicit terms, can have implicit terms. So I think the court's simply wrong there. But now let's get into practice tips, because you know what? A court in your state might be wrong about this same issue as well. How do you guard against that? Well, the first way you can guard against it is to put in your MOUs an enforcement clause that describes how the MOU is going to be enforced. And those enforcement clauses, the ones I always see, say the terms of this memorandum of understanding shall be enforceable through the grievance procedure in the collective bargaining agreement. That's a very simple solution. The second solution is that once your contract comes up for negotiations for a new contract, You go out there, you collect all the MOUs that you negotiated under the previous contract, and you incorporate them into the contract, or you modify them if the other side won't agree to the incorporation on a verbatim basis. But you don't have these straggling MOUs from 8 years ago that someone is going to have to try to track down and then enforce. That's the second thing that you can do. Third, you know, there's more than just a grievance procedure you can bring to bear on these kinds of cases. I've said a couple of times that the provision of the retiree medical benefits in this case were a past practice, right? One that went on for 8 years since the MOU was agreed to. Can you enforce a past practice through a contract? Sure. But is there another way to enforce a past practice? Of course. You can enforce a past practice by filing an unfair labor practice complaint, alleging that the deviation from the past practice is a breach of the employer's obligation to collectively bargain in good faith. Now, it may be that the FOP here, it may be that the FOP actually did file an unfair labor practice complaint. The court's opinion doesn't refer to that at all. I would hope that the FOP did so, because otherwise, this decision from the Ohio Court of Appeals is the end of the case. The last case I want to talk about this month is another patronage case. And I know I've talked about patronage cases a fair amount over the years, but I think it's really timely to talk about this one with the public discussion that is out there that police officers should not have any disciplinary protections or protections from unfair discipline. And I want to talk about this case because it's really a pretty good example of what can happen in the absence of collective bargaining agreements or any other meaningful job protections. So this is a case out of Missouri, and it comes out of Christian County, Missouri, and the Sheriff's Department. And they had a sheriff by the name of Joey Kyle. Joey got in trouble with federal law, ended up pleading guilty to a federal offense. And in his wake, four candidates ran for sheriff in the general election. And one of them was Brad Cole. He was the Republican candidate. And the other was Keith Mills. He was the independent candidate. Mills was the only candidate who had actually worked for the sheriff's department. And between the time that Sheriff Kyle resigned and the election, you had an interim sheriff, a guy named Dwight McNeil. Okay, so those are our characters here. You've got Dwight McNeil, interim sheriff. You have Cole, who's the Republican candidate, and Mills, who's the independent candidate. The independent candidate, Mills, had the support of many sheriff's department employees. One of the deputy sheriffs publicly endorsed Mills, posted on Facebook, talked to people, knocked on doors, put up a yard sign, that sort of stuff. Another deputy sheriff told family and friends to vote for Mills and loaned Mills a flatbed trailer for Mills to use in a public parade. That second deputy actually told three or four people in the sheriff's office that, quote, if you elect Brad Cole, you're trading one crook for another. 1 week before the election, when things have really heated up, McNeil, remember him, the interim sheriff, tells deputy number two, the one who loaned the flatbed trailer, that he needed, quote, to be on the right side to keep his job, and the right side is Cole. Another one of McNeil's interim command staff members told various people several times before the election about the need to support Cole in the election. Prior to the election, Cole would come to the sheriff's office. He'd meet with this interim staff, and then the interim staff would go out and talk to the deputies and tell them they had a 1 in 4 chance, remember, four candidates, 1 in 4 chance of keeping their jobs. Well, of course, Cole wins the election. You know where this is going, right? And on August 7th, Cole assumes the duties of sheriff. And what does he do? He terminates the two deputies who supported his opponent, who supported Mills. These two deputies, one of them's name is Tim Bruce and the other's name is Robert Curtis. These two deputies sue and they allege that their terminations violated their First Amendment rights to free speech, First Amendment rights to engage in political activity. And the federal Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected the lawsuit. The court said, look, long ago, the U.S. Supreme Court held that a government employer can take adverse disciplinary action against employees for what would otherwise be protected First Amendment activities if they hold confidential or policymaking positions for which political loyalty is necessary for effective job performance. So these sorts of cases, these patronage cases, come down to, look, is the person who got fired, are they in a confidential or policy-making position? And in most courts, you see these lines being divided somewhere in the rank structure, right? And when I say most courts, I mean there's 12 essential federal courts of appeals, and all except three of them would draw a line somewhere in the rank structure. And usually it's north of captain, that somebody who is higher in rank than a captain is a policymaker, is a confidential employee, and can be fired at will. But people, captain and below, can't be. But there's these other three federal courts of appeals, and the Eighth Circuit is one of these other three federal courts of appeals. And here's what the court says. Sheriffs in Missouri are elected officials who are empowered to appoint their deputies. The court says that sheriff's deputies are their agents who hold their office at the pleasure of the sheriff. And the court says the deputy sheriff has all the powers and may perform any of the duties of the sheriff. Think about that for a moment. In any law enforcement agency, does the lowest rank and file level, in this case, deputy sheriff, have the ability to perform all of the duties of the highest ranking individual? Here, the sheriff? Well, this is the world in which this court is living. Now I'm going to quote from the court's opinion. Under Missouri law, a deputy sheriff is the alter ego of the sheriff. Missouri deputy sheriffs are at-will employees. Because Curtis and Bruce, in their role as Missouri deputy sheriffs, held policymaking positions for which political loyalty is necessary to an effective job performance, Cole was permitted to fire them and did not violate their constitutional rights. And indeed, there are patronage cases where it's more than just two deputies, where a new sheriff comes in and fires the entire sheriff's department. And if you're in one of these three areas of the country, courts have upheld those sorts of patronage discharge. So this very, very difficult case. And again, I offer it to you only as sort of a morality story as to what can happen when job protections go away. So that's the end of our August podcast. I am sorry for the somewhat down tone of this podcast. And here is hoping that when you hear me in September, and hopefully you'll join me in September, here's hoping we've had a much, much better month than we have had in the last 31 days. So with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.